Hi, this is Faith Mitchell, President of Grantmakers in Health. I'd like to welcome you to the latest edition in GIH's podcast series. Our goal is to provide you with an insider's view of what's happening on the front lines of health by hearing from leaders in the field. I hope you enjoy these podcasts and find them insightful as you lead your philanthropic work.
Please join me in welcoming Richard Besser.
It is truly an honor to be here, to be speaking with you this morning. This is my first Grantmakers in Health meeting, and it's a wonderful place to be. The organization has been so important to us at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. The community that has been built here has improved our work profoundly. Before I enter into my remarks, I just want to take a moment and congratulate Dr. Faith Mitchell on her incredible tenure here at the foundation. You know, my first GIH meeting is her last GIH meeting, and she has truly lifted this organization to new heights. She has focused on the importance of strengthening connections between all of us, building partnerships. She's cultivated a professional network that has improved the work at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation enormously, and I know the work for all of us. And so thank you for that, and I wish you well in the next chapters that come. Last night when Faith was talking, she talked a little bit about the importance of health equity, and that's what I want to be talking about to you this morning. I'm going to talk about a culture of health. I'll talk about how health equity is essential and inseparable from the vision that we have for a culture of health in America, how we define and talk about health equity, how we use stories and data to make the concepts of health equity more real. And I'll share examples of how we're working to incorporate health equity into all we do at the foundation. And then hopefully we'll have some time for conversation, hear from you, questions you have, but also for me, I look forward to hearing how you are thinking about health equity. Clearly, health equity is something that resonates in this room. I've been hearing it a lot over the past 2 days. I was thrilled that at the health equity listening session we sponsored on Tuesday, more than 50 members of Grantmakers in Health were there. They were sharing their approaches to health equity. Everyone was learning from each other. It's going to improve the work that we do, and we are so excited about that community of practice that's coming together. So, a culture of health. 6 years ago, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation embraced the vision of building what we call a culture of health in America, and it's a recognition that health is connected to every aspect of our lives. Access to healthcare is important. Access to healthcare is a right. High quality, comprehensive, affordable healthcare should be within everyone's reach. But if we think about health as being equated with access to healthcare, we are going to achieve a nation that is not very healthy at all. Being healthy requires an understanding that health is connected to where we live and where we work, where children learn and play. Those things are absolutely essential to health. Those exposures in early life, both positive and negative. Access to safe and affordable housing. Schools that provide a good education and meet the needs of every child. Access to healthy food and safe places for children to play. Secure jobs that provide living wages and transportation to get there. A healthcare system that truly meets the needs and goals of the people it serves. And the removals of the barriers to health that are caused by such things as structural racism, sexism, ageism, and other forms of discrimination. The concept of a culture of health and barriers to opportunity is something that I've seen in my practice as a general pediatrician. I've been fortunate in all the jobs that I've had that I've been able to spend a half day a week working in a federally qualified health center. And in each of those clinics, I've seen those barriers. I've seen the problems with opportunity. I remember when I was at the CDC and working in a clinic in Atlanta, this little six-year-old boy who we were taking care of who just wasn't gaining weight. He wasn't thriving. And we asked questions about food. We asked questions about his life. And we just couldn't figure out what was going on. And then finally, the registrar in the clinic developed enough trust with little boy's mom that she explained that he just wasn't getting enough to eat. In America, a child not getting enough to eat. His family were undocumented immigrants, and so they weren't eligible for the programs in Atlanta to provide food. 1 in 6 children in America every day don't know whether they're going to have enough to eat. That should be unacceptable. In New York City, I worked in a clinic that took care mainly of foster care children. And I remember this grandmother who traveled 2 hours from Staten Island to see me up in Harlem. And we were talking about physical activity, and she knew the CDC guidelines that recommend an hour a day, 5 days a week for children. And she had a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old grandchild. And she told me that they spend the afternoon sitting in front of the television. And the reason is, not that she didn't know the guidelines, the reason was it wasn't safe for them to go outside to play. Another little boy in New York with severe asthma who was ending up in the emergency room just about every month. We tested him and he was allergic to dust mites, but he had a landlord who didn't really care and wasn't willing to do the environmental cleanup in that apartment to keep that boy breathing easily. And now in Trenton, in the clinic where I currently work, the mother of a 5-year-old boy with severe developmental disabilities who knows what her child needs in terms of services, and she's been waiting more than 2 years to get her child those services that will allow him to reach his full potential. These are just a few examples of what lack of opportunity for health can look like in America. When we think about the concept of health equity, this idea of fair opportunity, we don't think of it as something radical. We view it really as a fundamental American value, and like so many values that we consider central to our democracy, it's aspirational. You know, beginning as children, we pledge allegiance to the flag with liberty and justice for all. We talk about this being a land of opportunity and the American dream that we can all strive to achieve, but we haven't lived up to that ideal. Our founding fathers who put forth these ideals didn't live up to them either. We've made progress since then, but history is filled with barriers that are set up at every level of society, deeply rooted, many times intentional. Some groups have a lifetime of benefits and opportunities because society has set it up that way. Others have barriers and burdens, again, because society has set it up that way. Nothing to do with how hard people work or how much education they have. It's the way the system is structured. You know, we talk about personal responsibility in health, and personal responsibility is really important. The choices people make matter. But the choices people make depend fundamentally on the choices that they have. And for far too many people, the choices just aren't there. Data is one of the ways that we try and bring these stories to life. You tell a story to capture someone's heart, and then you come at them with data, and hopefully their mind will follow. And the one that I want to talk about right now is structural racism. Life expectancy is heavily dependent on where we live. And take a look at this map. You may have seen maps like this for areas in which you live. This is a map of the area around Trenton, New Jersey. Trenton is the capital of New Jersey, and it's in Mercer County. In the upper right of that graph, you'll see Princeton Junction train station. That's really close to where the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is located. Life expectancy in that area at birth is 87 years. The community is largely white. Down in the lower left corner, you'll see the New Jersey State House in Trenton. Life expectancy for a child born there is 73 years. It's about 14 miles away from the foundation. Trenton is predominantly African American. So 14 miles, 14-year difference in life expectancy. So heading down Route 1, you lose about a year for every mile you travel between Princeton and Trenton. You can look at this map and say, well, why don't people from Trenton simply move to Princeton, right? It's obvious. You gain 14 years right away. If you look at the history of housing policy in America, you can see how segregation has been baked into it throughout our history. Richard Rothstein laid this out last year in a really powerful book, The Color of Law. Almost every policy related to housing, from the zoning codes that determine what gets built where to the lending rules that determine who is worthy of a mortgage and where people can buy houses, to the tax assessment on properties. These were specifically established to promote and maintain segregation in America. And as a result, for most of the past century, African Americans and other people of color have been denied the means to own property, to accumulate wealth, and to pass it on to their children. They've also had to live for generations with the ongoing stress of discrimination in education, employment, the justice system, and the medical system. And that impacts on health. Another source of data that we use very frequently are the county health rankings. And we put these out for a little over 10 years. And what they do is they break down every county in America based on health. So in every state, you can see counties are ranked from best to worst in terms of health, in terms of a wide range of health outcomes, as well as the drivers for health. Well, last year, for the first time, we put out the county health rankings, not just looking at place, not just by county, but we broke it down by race. the health indicators for Black Americans, Latinos, and Native Americans were worse than for whites across the board. It didn't matter if you were in the healthiest county in your state or the least healthy. People of color did not fare as well. Here's one statistic. Black babies across America are more than twice as likely to die as white babies before reaching their first year of life. This is data from the CDC. And some will look at that and say, well, maybe race is a marker for income or education. Well, here's a study that we funded at the Brookings Institute that breaks down infant mortality by race and education level. So across the x-axis, you'll see maternal educational attainment. On the far left, that's eighth grade or less, all the way up to the far right, which is an advanced professional degree. The orange bars are for white women, the blue bars are for Black women. At every level of education, the infant mortality rate for Black babies is much higher than it is for white. But look at this closely. What you'll see is that a baby born to a Black woman with an advanced professional degree is more likely to die in the first year of life than a baby born to a white woman with an eighth grade or less level of education. That just shouldn't be. And after birth, the situation, the prospects, the opportunities continue to be worse for people of color. We funded research by Raj Chetty and colleagues at Harvard that looks at upward mobility. This is that idea of anyone can achieve the American dream of upward mobility. The study he did was pretty incredible. He followed 20 million children. He linked together census data and tax data and was able to follow children from birth through the 30 years of life. And here's what he found. So this is looking at boys who are born into low-income homes. And the bar on the right is white boys in low-income homes. You'll see 9.2% of them were able to achieve that American dream and rise to high income, compared to only 2.3% of Black boys born in those homes, a four times difference. And then looking at children who were born with a silver spoon into a high-income home, 39% of white boys were able to stay at that income level compared to only 17% of Black boys. These data may not come as a surprise to you, but they've helped paint a clearer picture of the situation for policymakers, for community development people, and for private industry. And it points directly to the impact race and place can have on a person's opportunity to thrive. I want to shift now and talk about how we're trying to address health equity through the work that we do. I joined the foundation a couple years ago, and when the foundation first started its work in health equity, we established a team called Achieving Health Equity. And they worked to develop health equity tools that could be used both inside and outside the foundation. They worked on grant making. But one thing that we recognize that if we are truly serious about health equity, if health equity is essential for building a culture of health, we couldn't have health equity sitting over here in a team on its own. It had to be integrated into all that we do. So we got rid of our health equity team. It was a risky move. The question was, when you get rid of health equity and you no longer have one team responsible, does it mean that no one's responsible? Well, what we've seen has been the exact opposite. Program teams have re-envisioned their strategies and approaches to incorporate health equity. We've been relying on the knowledge of people our programs are intended to benefit as experts to help us plan, develop, and evaluate our work. Another question we've had is, you know, have we strayed from the mission of our founder? This is our founder, Robert Wood Johnson II. And I argue that no, health equity is really something that was fundamental to his vision of America. He was a strong supporter of what he called the inner dignity of people. And in his writings and his testimony before Congress, he maintained that the United States could not thrive unless workers had safe places to work, fair pay, and good health. He said that someone in America should be able to work 40 hours a week and have enough to take care of their family and enjoy some of the finer things in life. And he worked to advance a higher minimum wage to help achieve that goal. Last evening, Faith said something that resonated with me. She said that if you ask 10 people to define health equity, you're going to get 10 different definitions. And I think that's right. For us, it was very important to focus on defining health equity for us. What does it mean? What are we talking about when we say health equity? And so we worked with Dr. Paula Braveman at the University of California, San Francisco, and others to put this into words, and it has basically two parts. First, it boiled down to ensuring that everyone has a fair and just opportunity to be as healthy as possible. But the second part is, I think, the most important part of the definition. And that means acknowledging that we have to work on removing the obstacles to health, such as poverty, discrimination, and their consequences, including powerlessness, lack of access to good jobs with fair pay, quality education and housing, safe environments, and healthcare. And that's really challenging. This definition for us has also been a living document. We're learning as we go. And when we first were using this definition, we talked about this as the goal of health equity for all Americans. And it was pointed out to us that, when you say all Americans, you're excluding non-citizens. So we've changed it, and we talk about for everyone in America. It may sound subtle, but it has real meaning. Another important step for us on our journey around health equity has been getting buy-in across the organization, from the board to all of our staff, staff who are involved in programs, staff who are involved in administrative support across the whole organization. And there are a number of ways we've been working to do this, and we're going to continue to work to do this. One is by bringing in outside voices and speakers to talk with us. Dr. David Williams, who's a professor at Harvard, is incredibly gifted at talking about structural racism, at presenting data that shows the true impact of racism on health. He came and spoke to our board and our staff, and he showed the impact in terms of life expectancy, in terms of infant mortality, in terms of premature death. It was a true aha moment for our board and for our staff. Dr. Mary Travis Bassett, the former New York City commissioner, came and spoke to our staff. Again, another very poignant, strong voice for health equity. We did a poverty simulation exercise in the foundation, and it allowed some staff to play the role of people struggling to navigate a discriminatory system. It allowed others to play the role of individuals who are perpetuating those obstacles. These kind of exercises, they don't let you fully experience what it's like to be poor, but it helps create a space for a conversation. And I think it's that conversation that comes out of it that's most valuable. We've been providing training on implicit bias. And once a month at our all-staff meeting, we share a story. These come from across the foundation. Staff members will share a story of how our grantee or a partner organization is building health equity into their work. We'll share a story about a struggle or an issue we've had within the foundation as we've worked to incorporate health equity into what we do. You know, we recognize that talking about health equity, and particularly talking about structural racism, it's challenging. You know, everyone comes to this conversation with their own lived experience. The conversations require an openness and a willingness to share, and also a willingness to acknowledge that we're going to make mistakes. We're going to say things that aren't quite right, that are going to hit someone wrong, and that's part of the process we're going through. You know, this is something for me that has been a challenge, learning to talk about structural racism and the importance of talking about that when I talk about health equity. And I remember a conversation I had with one of our communication officers about this. It was right before I was about to go on stage at a program that was about race and place and health. And I said, you know, who am I to be talking about racism? And what she said, and she's African-American, I deeply believe this, is that we're never going to make the kind of progress we need to make in America if we view structural racism and other forms of discrimination as problems that should be dealt with and solved by those who are the victims of those systems. You know, structural racism is relational, and as a privileged white man in a position of power, it's very important that I see myself and our organization as part of that conversation and part of the solution. I recognize that my understanding of racism and discrimination is never going to be as deep as it should be. I spend a lot of time listening, learning, reading, strengthening my relationships with people who have been working in the area of health equity and structural racism for a long time. We put a lot of effort into how we talk about issues of health equity. During my time at ABC News, I learned the importance of words. Words can build bridges or they can put up walls. And so we have worked really hard and done formative research to think about how do you talk about health equity in a way that allows a conversation to occur. We created a graphic that we found to be very helpful in distinguishing between equality and equity. So this is our bicycle graphic. And say you have a situation in which you want people to ride bikes. That's the outcome you're looking for. The top is a situation of equality. You have a population, you give everyone a nice bike. Well, Here's what happens. If you look on the left, you have a woman there with a disability. She's in a wheelchair. She can't ride that bike. The next person over, he's kind of like me. He's very tall. He can ride that bike, but after an hour on that bike, he's going to be a mess. So you're not doing his health a lot of good. The woman, her bike fits her, and she's doing great. And the little kid, his feet don't even reach the pedals. So it's equal, they all got a bike, but you're not having the outcome you wanted. If you look below that in a situation of health equity, everyone gets what they need to be able to make a healthy choice and take a healthy action. So the woman with a disability has a recumbent bike. I have a bike that fits me. The woman still has the same bike, and the little kid has a bike that is sized appropriately. That's what we mean when we talk about health equity, everyone having what they need to make a healthy choice. One tool that we use in communicating about health equity is our work with the media. And each year, we sponsor a poll that's done by National Public Radio and the Harvard Chan School of Public Health on a topic that relates in some way to a culture of health. Well, last year, the poll that we commissioned with them was a comprehensive look at discrimination in America, the experience that people living in America have with discrimination. Researchers at Harvard designed a survey that would allow adults from across the nation to talk about their experiences in a lot of different domains, so interactions with police, going to the doctor, renting an apartment or buying a house, applying for a job or going to college. And more than 3,400 people participated in this survey. African Americans, Latinos, whites, Native Americans, Asian Americans, people who identify as LGBTQ. Then NPR took these findings and they produced dozens of stories that hit the airways that talked about discrimination in America. And I want to share one story with you that ran on All Things Considered. So this is Laura and Gustavo, and they're newlyweds, and they were living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And they wanted to move into a bigger house, and they saw one for rent in their neighborhood. So Gustavo called the real estate agent. Listen to what happened.
I left a voicemail. I said, my name is Gustavo. I live in the neighborhood, but I'm interested in moving into another home, and that I was a young married guy looking for a place to live.
But he didn't hear back.
He called her back a week later, something like that. She didn't return his call.
So after not hearing back twice,
I said, I don't want to make any assumptions here, but I was like, why don't you give him a call and see if you get a call back? And she left a message saying, you know, this is Laura. I live in the neighborhood. Just kind of a similar message.
And when I called and said my name, which sounds very white, the woman texted me back like within 5 minutes.
And we just kind of looked at each other and I kind of started, you know, laughing. Hey, this kind of stuff happens all the time. But she got really upset.
I had a much stronger reaction. I was livid. The only different information she had between the two voicemails were our names.
So according to this poll, nearly one-third of Latinos and a quarter of Asian Americans say that they have been personally discriminated against when applying for jobs or being considered for a promotion or looking to rent or buy a home. Among African Americans, that number jumps to more than 55%. Some of the things that we learned from that poll is that every group in America, a percentage, have experienced discrimination. But for people of color, the rates were far, far higher. And importantly for all of us, because we work in the area of health, one out of every three Black Americans and one out of every five Native Americans and Latinos say that they've experienced racial discrimination visiting a doctor or a health clinic, and that it often makes them avoid getting necessary treatment or screening that could improve their health. As a society, we need to acknowledge that grappling with the stress of prejudice and discrimination, as well as the insidious features of structural racism, can lead to serious health issues. And stories like this can help people connect to those experiences and make them common experiences. Health equity has become a key consideration in how we pick winners for our annual Culture of Health Prize. This is a prize that celebrates communities in America that are working together to build a culture of health. And now as part of that prize, finalists have to be actively working across sectors to improve opportunities for health and well-being. And that's what we mean when we talk about health equity. We've also established a prize, the RWJF Health Equity Awards, that celebrate individuals and groups who've changed systems and policies at the local level to advance health equity. I want to talk a little bit about some other things we're doing structurally. Every year we put out an executive team goals that really are a commitment to ourselves as an organization, a commitment to the board about what we're working to accomplish. And last year we added health equity goals to that. These three: elevate our commitment and leadership on health equity, embed equity in every programmatic unit, and promote a shared understanding of equity among staff. And I've talked about a number of those, but I want to just give you a few more examples of how we're embedding this into our programmatic units. We worked hard to look at the work plans that each of our teams and themes and organizations had, our programs, our leadership, our communication and research. And we've intentionally worked to pivot that work to include health equity in all of that. The first example I want to hit on comes from our Leadership for Better Health team. A few years ago, we revamped our leadership programs and created change leadership programs. Very exciting work. One of those programs is called the Interdisciplinary Research Leaders Program. And this takes a team of two people from academics and academic research institutions and one community leader. And they address the research questions and concerns of a community and apply that academic research lens to it. Here's one such team that have looked to advance health and health equity through their research. This is Irene Yen, Susan Neufeld, and Leslie Dubin of San Francisco, and they're interdisciplinary research leaders. One's a professor of medicine, one is vice president of a nonprofit developer of affordable housing, and the third is a member of the San Francisco Department of Public Health. And their research focuses on the role of housing in health equity. And specifically, they're looking at the impact on health when a public entity turns over their public housing to private development. So recently, the city of San Francisco collaborated with the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development to turn over all its public housing to private property management companies and developers. The team is tracking the prevalence of health-specific conditions like high blood pressure and asthma, physical trauma, as well as the residents' access to healthcare services before and after the renovations. And they're studying how private housing developers view health and well-being since they've entered this work. The next example comes from our Healthy Children and Families team. And this team is focused on ensuring that all families, no matter what their backgrounds may be, have what they need to foster the healthy physical, social, and emotional development of kids from their earliest years. One of the ways that they've worked to embed equity into their work is by developing a health equity technical assistance hub that's going to launch in a couple months. This offers resources to grantees, their home organizations, to help address health equity. It has a built-in quality improvement process that provides ongoing feedback. Hopefully, this assistance is effective in meeting their needs, whether they're novices to health equity, rock stars, or somewhere in between. It's a good example of how our work is improved when we work with grantees to help shape that work. The last example is one that comes from our communication department, and one of their goals is to create research-based strategies to shift the narrative about health equity. To meet this goal, they've been doing ongoing message testing with groups across the political spectrum. And this is really important. We view ourselves as a nonpartisan voice in health. We want to make sure that the words we use don't alienate half the room just as we're starting to have a conversation. And here's what we've learned so far. Even with groups that are ideologically opposed, there are four things that you can do to communicate about health equity so it resonates. First, use relatable stories, like the story of Laura and Gustavo. Next, use data to back up the claims, like the data showing that Black babies in America fare far worse than white babies. Third, focus on solutions and examples of communities coming together, like we do with our Culture of Health Prize-winning communities. And then framing health equity as opportunity. These frames tend to work across all audiences that we speak to. Lastly, I want to touch on some work we're doing with other foundations that is really important when it comes to health equity. This is a new initiative. It's called the President's Council on Disability Inclusion and Philanthropy. And I co-chair this with Darren Walker of the Ford Foundation. Wayne Proctor, who leads this effort for us, is here if you want to follow up on this. And there are a dozen foundations that have joined this effort, and it comes from a recognition that unless you're a philanthropy that is specifically focused on the needs of people with disabilities, there's a good chance that your work is excluding those communities. Ford Foundation convened heads of philanthropies to look at this issue. And what we're trying to do is go on a journey and look to see how can we be inclusive in our work of everyone in America? How can we look to make sure that through our grant making, through our convening, through our communications, through our housing, we are inclusive of people with disabilities? It's not a new area of work. It's an opportunity to look at what we do and make sure that everyone is welcome and part of it. I encourage you, if it resonates with you, to speak with Dwayne or contact us and we can tell you how to get involved. So to close, I'd like to challenge all of us to be more active, more vocal, and a whole lot bolder when it comes to health equity. Let's keep asking ourselves critical questions. Who is benefiting most from the work that we do? Whose life experiences are we not representing? And how does that skew our efforts and our outcomes? Let's continue to ask our partners, our collaborators, and our grantees to make sure they include all voices and life experiences at the table when they plan and execute their programs. If we can do that, we'll be living up to the highest principles of our work and setting a standard for others to follow, building a culture of health that truly respects the rights and dignity of all. So thank you for inviting me to speak this morning, and I'm really looking forward to hearing from you. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast. For more information about Grantmakers in Health, visit us online at gih.org.